alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want you to know right from the start, I am not a morning person. I was trying to talk Rick last night into taking this camera up to my room this morning, letting me lay in bed and give my talk from there. And they weren't going for it. I want to thank the committee for inviting me. This has just been something. I got landed yesterday evening, and the limousine picked me up. And, you know, I'm such a pervert. I'm asking the Jerry who's driving the limo if anybody ever did it in the back of his limo. the first thing I think about. And we for $100, he said, you can do anything back there. Then we got here and had a really nice dinner and enjoyed Marty last night. My clothes consultant advised me to take my name badge off because as we were watching Marty on the screen, of course, we were sitting right at the front table, but we were watching him on the screen over there. We noticed that the light was reflecting off his name badge, so they advised me to take mine off before I talked this morning. And, you know, one thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, you just get a lot of help from a lot of people. Everybody seems to have something to contribute to your talk in the morning. I was on the computer the other day, about a month ago, I guess, and I was playing Wheel of Fortune, and I noticed Vanna White was moving a little slow across the screen, and so I immediately ordered a new motherboard. And when my motherboard arrived, I had to buy a new hard drive, and so I just got a 2.5 gigabyte. I just need something small at home. And and then, of course, I had to buy a 3D video card. And while I'm at it, I might as well put a fast modem in. And I want to tell you, Vanna White's moving at a good speed across the screen now. Unfortunately, I can't do anything else with the computer. I've upgraded myself right out of my ability to use the computer. And the reason I share that with you is because it's alcoholism. It is not alcoholism. I suffer from alcoholism. If one is good, 10 is better. Doesn't matter what it is. If Vanna's moving too slow, spend $1,200, get her moving at a good click, but don't be able to do anything else. It's alcoholism, and I have it, and I will have it, and I will have it, and I will have it. It just manifests itself in different ways. And it seems to me that my alcoholism doesn't do anything deadly to me unless I drink alcohol. My alcoholism doesn't kill me unless I drink alcohol, but it manifests itself all over the place. And you're all probably a lot healthier than I am, but mine comes out day after day after day. And that's the reason that I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the reason that I continue to come to meetings. That's the reason that I continue to listen to you share with me how to live, because you keep my alcoholism in check. My alcoholism is like a little tiger pup, and I have this little, you know how cute little tiger pups are when they're puppies? They're furry, and they're cuddly, and they're fun, and they're playful, and they run around, and they're really cute. And I have that little tiger pup inside of me, and that's my alcoholism. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, the little tiger pup fell asleep. And every day that I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, the little tiger pup's asleep, but it's been growing. And today I have a full-grown tiger inside of me. And full-grown tigers aren't pretty, and they aren't cute, and they aren't playful, and they aren't cuddly. They're deadly. But the tiger can't hurt me because he's asleep. And the only thing that'll wake up the tiger is if I take a drink of alcohol. If I take a drink of alcohol and wake up the tiger, I'm in big trouble. But you know what? Every once in a while, my tiger rolls over and kicks an arm. Every once in a while, my tiger has indigestion. If I don't take a drink, that's all it is the tiger rolling over. And I do some pretty bizarre things. But because the steps work, and because you've been willing to share with me how to live life, when my tiger rolls over and gives me a little kick, I don't have to take a drink. And I have tools that allow me to live life on a daily basis. And that's what you've given me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't come here for that. I don't know why anybody else came, but I didn't come for that. I came to stay out of jail. That's the only reason I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a driving problem when I arrived here. I had been arrested for my 12th drunk driving assault, and I don't know about anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I never had resentments until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I never had resentments out there. And one of my early resentments in Alcoholics Anonymous was I discovered you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I never knew that because I always got arrested for drunk driving assault. And it had something to do with how I got out of the car. I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that it's not okay to try and knock the policeman's private parts off with the door of your car. And the insanity of my disease is I get pulled over and I look at the cop. And I think, one of him, one of me. One on one. Good fight. One on one. Fair fight. And I jump out of the car fighting. Now, you know what? The cop always calls in his friends. And then they call in their friends. And pretty soon there's six of them and one of you, and it's not fair anymore. And you're on the ground, and you're getting the living poop beat out of you, and it suddenly occurs to you it's not fair anymore. And you look up, and you get that sweet little smile, and you say, Uncle. But the next time, you do it again. The next time I get stopped, I look, and I think, one of him, one of me, fair fight. One of him, one of me, this is going to be okay. And I jump out of the car, and he calls in his friend, and they call in their friends. And I do that over and over and over. Never occurs to me that it's going to be the same way. And that's the insanity of my disease. I do the same thing over and over and over, and I expect different results. I expect that somehow this time it's going to turn out different. Somehow this time I'm going to beat him. I'm going to get out of here. I mean, it never works that way. I was a bar drinker. I was a living room drinker, a bedroom drinker, an alley drinker, a dumpster drinker, a living room drinker. I didn't specialize. I just sort of drank. But I love bars. I love sleazy bars. I love really sleazy bars. And I know there's a couple in this town. but I love those bars with sawdust on the floor and the mirrors are cracked and the poster around the bar is ripped where people have tried to hold on as they're falling off the bar stool. And they're full of smoke. They've got that wonderful used booze urine smell that I salivate still when I think about it. I love that smell, but you know what? I'm absolutely fascinated in Alcoholics Anonymous in retrospect, and that's, I don't know about you, but that's all I know. My whole story is in retrospect. My sponsor always tells me when I do this, I should tell you my name and tell you the truth. I've told you my name. I'm not so sure I'm telling you the truth. What I'm telling you is my perspective of the truth. I mean, I didn't know it was going to be important. I didn't know that I was going to end up in Alcoholics Anonymous being required to report what it used to be like. If I would have known I was going to be here, I would have done some things differently. If I would have known I was going to be here, I would have taken notes. If I would have known it was going to be important, if I would have known about a fourth and fifth step, I would not have done some of the things that I did. But I didn't know it was going to be important. I didn't know it was going to end up here, so I didn't pay a lot of attention to it. So a lot of what I share with you was reported to me by other people. And I just sort of have to believe they were telling me the truth. I have a job. I had to get a fingerprint clearance, and I am really good at fingerprinting. I fingerprint good. I've done it enough. And I'm being fingerprinted, and I don't want to raise any red flags. So I very kind of calmly say to the woman fingerprinting me, how far are you going to check? And she said to me, looked me in the eye and said, from the day you were born. And I thought, oh, my God, this is like a fifth step, only it's in the wrong order. Because they're going to know before I do. And sure enough, my report came back, and, you know, I don't know if you know normal people. I know a few normal people. I think they are really very strange, and I think that would be programs for them. But this woman is a normal person. You know how they talk to us sometimes? They get, like, this tone in their voice, like, your report came back. Normally, these reports are two or three pages long. Yours was 45 pages. And she asked me if I wanted to come see it. Well, of course I did. I went down there, and you know what? I know more about my story after seeing that than I did before. And the book says it. It says more will be revealed. It doesn't say how. And that's how I know most of my story. Most of my story other people told me about. And And most of my, all of my stories in retrospect, but I'm fascinated by sleazy bars. I'm fascinated by the quality of people who were in there. I mean, there were bank presidents. There were CEOs of big companies. There were neurosurgeons. There were admirals in the Air Force. I mean, that's what they said they were. And but I had this driving problem, and I don't know if it was a good thing or a bad thing. It was a thing. I drank during the time when drunk driving wasn't really a big deal. I mean, they didn't make such a big deal about it. And you'd get arrested for drunk driving. You'd call an attorney. You'd give him $1,000. He'd go do whatever he did. He'd call you up and tell you got reduced to this or got dismissed or this happened or that happened, or you have to send him $200. I mean, that was the end of it. But this one time I had two drunk driving assaults pending at the same time. And my attorney was a little nervous about it. And I thought, well, if my attorney's going to be nervous, I guess I ought to be nervous about it. So I was worried about it. And I was sitting in this bar one night worrying about these two drunk driving assaults I had, and started chatting with this guy next to me, and as it turned out, he worked at a mortuary. And I came up with a plan, and I think as alcoholics, we come up with really good plans really quickly. And we went over to the mortuary where he worked, and we got a death certificate. And we put my name on it, and we filled out all the information. We forged the doctor's signature, and we sent it to the judge. Because he can't expect you to show up if you're dead. And I called my attorney the next day, and I told him he didn't need to worry about it. And he didn't worry. I didn't worry. Nobody worried about it for about a month. And then I got stopped for drunk driving assault again. And, you know what? I remember that time the judge wanted to see me. I couldn't figure out why. I'd never been there before, but I went that time. And I'll never forget them. You know how they sit way up higher than you are, and they wear all black, and they're very... And he looked at me and asked me the most ignorant question. He looked at me and he said, Miss Ochoa, he said, tell me, how is it a dead person is standing in my court? And I shrugged my shoulders. I said, I don't know, bad luck. And and that's what I thought it was. I thought it was bad luck. I thought it was circumstances and conditions. I thought it was the cops. I thought it was you and they and them. It never occurred to me it had anything to do with drinking. It never occurred to me that it had anything to do with drinking. And that just was it, on and on and on and on. I mean, it just never got much different than that. I had an opportunity to go to college. I did very well. I graduated from college with a 3.8 grade point average, a chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic, only I don't know it. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I'm drinking alcoholically on a daily basis, and I graduate from college with a 3.8 grade point average. That almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I got here, I told you I was too smart to be an alcoholic. Nobody with a 3.8 grade point average could possibly be an alcoholic. And I'd taken classes for a master's degree. I was way too smart. I was way too successful to be an alcoholic. I'd left college. I'd gone immediately into the profession of my choice. I'd risen very quickly to the top. And I told you I was way too successful to be an alcoholic. I had trophies. I had plaques that said I was good at what I did. And I told you about those. And I told you about the big oak desk that I sat behind. And what I didn't tell you about was the mornings that I would come to wrapped around the leg of that desk, the cleaning lady coming in. And I don't know anybody but an Al-Anon who enjoys the sound of a vacuum cleaner, but... Sorry, Bob. But I'm telling her I don't need my office clean today. I like it this way. And I know there's a bottle in that bottom desk drawer, and if I can just get a hit off of that bottle, I'm going to be okay. And what I didn't tell you about, I was in the newspaper business, and we often gave awards, and I know today it was because God gave me a gift. We often won awards. And what I didn't tell you about was the times I would come to out of a blackout behind a podium much like this in a room full of people holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And so I would say thank you, and I would go sit down, and then somebody would elbow me and tell me I was presenting it to the Junior Women's League, and I'd have to get up and start over again. And I didn't tell you about that. I just told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. And I was 26 years old, and I was way too young to be an alcoholic. 21 years ago, 26 was young in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody in the meetings were as old as I am now or older. And I was way too young to be an alcoholic. And all those things almost killed me when I came here. Almost killed me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. It had all the reasons why I didn't belong. Did we just lose power or what? Suddenly everybody disappeared, which is... I'm not a morning person, thank you. It's really 10 o'clock at night. Okay. All right, let me give my talk now. I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous with a bad attitude. I didn't belong here. I went to court. I was 26 years old. I stood in court drunk. It's the only way I went to court. It's the only way I went to the laundromat, the grocery store. It's the only way I went to work, the library. It's the only way I did anything. Stood in court drunk that morning, being sentenced to 10 years in prison. And in the middle of sentencing me, the expression on the judge's face changed and the tone of his voice got different. And I know he was as surprised at what he was saying as I was at what I was hearing. Because in the middle of sentencing me, he looked at me and he said, I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you one more chance. And he offered me an alternative. And part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wish I could tell you that I took the alternative. I came here. I looked at the 12 steps. I knew they were the solution to the problems in my life. I worked them all in the first week and skyrocketed to recovery. And if Bill George wasn't here, I would tell you that. But but that's not my story. I drank for 3 more months. In retrospect, I can tell you that I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. I didn't drink a greater quantity. Physically, it would have been impossible to drink a greater quantity of alcohol. But I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, the day before I was to go back to court to tell the judge what I was doing with the alternative he gave me, on that day I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know what ANA was. I mean, I thought it was something like the PTA or Parents Without Partners. And, well, a lot of days it is, but I... But I didn't know what you people were going to do to me or for me. I didn't have any, as far as I know, I had never heard the words Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea what would happen here. And it was a Sunday night, and I went to that, it was a speaker meeting, and I don't know who spoke that night, but I heard 2 things. I heard that we don't drink between meetings. And I quickly looked around the meeting, and I didn't see any of you drinking during the meeting. And I thought, if you don't drink between the meetings and you're not drinking in the meeting, when are you going to drink? This made me nervous. The other thing that I heard was that the answers were in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. I mean, God knows I need to have the answers. And I can't tell you how irritated I was when I got home. Not only could I not find the answers in this book, I couldn't even find the questions. And I thought, oh, dear God, I've stolen the wrong book, and I'm going to have to go back and get the right one. And I'm a thief. Now, I don't know I'm a thief. You know what? I think it's really critical that you have a sponsor. I think it's even more critical that you have a sponsor who's not as emotionally involved in your life as you are. It irritates me sometimes, but it's really important because my sponsor has a different perspective of my life than I do. My sponsor has to tell me I'm a thief. I don't know I'm a thief. I'm a bar drinker. I'm going to school in San Diego. The bar closes. It's time to go home. I pick up some keys off the bar. I find the car that they fit, and I drive home. My sponsor and the San Diego police think this is Grand Theft Auto. I think it's alternative transportation. I mean, my disease manifests itself in justification. I can make myself right without missing a heartbeat. I have a reason why I do what I do without missing a breath. And I just need to get home. I'm not stealing anybody's car. But if the police catch you, they think it's Grand Theft Auto. I'd like to come to your house and shop. My sponsor and the police think this is burglary. I think it's shopping. And I don't know I'm a thief, but I'm a thief. And it's humiliating for a thief to have stolen the wrong book. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous 4 days later to get the answer book. That's the only reason I came back. I don't think it matters what brings you back. I think what's important is that you come back. I don't think it matters what your motive is, what your intention is, what your desires are. I think what's important is that you come back. I came back 4 days later to get the answer book, and I've been coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous ever since. And I never planned to stay this long. My court program said I had to stay for 15 months. I thought that was a little obsessive. You'd already told me I couldn't drink. You already told me the answers were in the book. I really didn't figure you had anything else to tell me. But I was willing to go to any lengths to stay out of prison, so I kept coming back. And I was not a nice newcomer. This volcano would go off inside of me. And when the volcano went off, I had to do something. I would stand up in the back of the room and tell the speaker what I thought of what they were saying. It was like profanities, but I strung them together so well it sounded like a sentence. And I would scream that out from the back of the room. Somebody would turn around, usually a little blue-haired lady, would turn around, smile, and say, keep coming back. And I'd wave my court card in her face and tell her I didn't have a choice. And I'd sit back down until it went off again, and then I'd be up again. And you'd come up and try and talk to me. I'd take a swing at you. I'd kick at you. I'd throw my coffee at you. Pretty soon, people weren't coming up to me anymore. And the only people who were coming up to me were people whose sponsors were annoyed with them. And if your sponsor was annoyed with you, he or she would point to me and say, see that woman back there? Go give her your phone number. And so being a good AA, you would do that, and I would go off. And I had to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time to discover that that anger was the cover for a tremendous amount of fear. I was absolutely scared to death. I was afraid of me, I was afraid of you, I was afraid of life. And I couldn't survive in places that I survived in with fear. And I began at an early age to cover that fear with anger. And by the time I got here, that's all I had. Everything was covered with anger and I acted out in violence. I had to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous a long time to discover that. I kept trying to get kicked out AA. You wouldn't kick me out. I didn't know you could just leave. It just didn't occur to me to just go. Because, you see, I have my little court program, and I thought, Marty talked about thinking. I think all the time. I'm talking to you, I'm thinking about something else. Then I start thinking about the fact that I shouldn't be thinking. Then I start thinking about how not to think about what I'm thinking about while I'm thinking what I shouldn't be thinking that I'm thinking. Then I start thinking about not thinking about, you know what, I'm grateful I don't have a loudspeaker on my head. So everything I thought came barreling out. I mean, that would be truly humiliating. But I thought y'all had bar patrol. Now, watch what happens after the meeting. It's a reasonable thought. I figured you came here, this is like a cover. The meeting was your cover. And then after the meeting, your real work started. Because you broke off into little groups. There'd be a little group here, there'd be a little group over there, there'd be a little group over there. There'd be all these little groups around the room talking. I figured those were the bar patrols. And y'all had your little area that you cruised through. And you went through all the bars in your little area. And if you saw anybody who had ever been in one of your A&A meetings, you grabbed them by the back of the neck, drug them off their bar stool, embarrassed them in front of all their peers, and drug them back to Alcoholics Anonymous. That kept me sober. My thinking kept me sober a lot. Because, you see, if I got caught drinking, I was going to prison for 10 years. So I figured you had to get thrown out of AA, and I was trying. I was trying really hard to get thrown out of AA. And one night I heard the traditions read. I know today they read them at every meeting, but I missed them for several months. And third tradition, the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. I leapt out of my chair. I was so excited. I said, that's it. I don't have a desire to stop drinking. I can't stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was on my way out, and an old-timer grabbed me. And thank God for the old-timers, and thank God they understood the traditions. This guy grabbed me, and he said, Pat, he said, there's a judge in South Orange County Court. He has a desire for you to stop drinking. And in your case, we're going to let that be enough. And I stayed on somebody else's desire. I don't think it matters whose desire you're here on. I think what's important is that you don't take a drink of alcohol. I don't think it matters whose desire you're here on, what your motive is. I don't think it matters if you're here to get a wife, lose a wife, get a job, lose a job. I don't think any of that matters. I think what's important is that you don't take a drink of alcohol. And I didn't take a drink of alcohol, and I didn't take a drink of alcohol, and I didn't take a drink of alcohol. And for me, it took 8.5 months to get far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism. You all saw it when I walked in. It was piled this high. I mean, just the way I looked. I had on a pair of jeans that had never been inside of a washer, and I was very proud of that. I wore a T-shirt. I wore a Coast Guard pea coat. I had no shoes. I'd had some at one time. I don't know what happened to them. I had my hair down. I wore dark glasses all the time. You all saw the evidence when I walked in. But you gave me the dignity to do what I had to do for as long as I had to do it, until I got far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism. And for me, it was 8.5 months. And at 8.5 months away from my last drink, I experienced the worst pain I've ever experienced. I think the worst pain for an alcoholic is when we're not drinking and not recovering. That pain of not drinking and not recovering at 8.5 months drove me to my knees. And on my knees, I took the first step of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I'm a strong person. I had a very difficult time with powerlessness. I had a very difficult time with unmanageability because I'd been very successful. I had a lot of successes, and I'm a very strong person. And I had a hard time accepting, looking at the word powerless, because I'm not. And unmanageability, because I'm not. And what I discovered at 8.5 months, far enough away to see the evidence. At 13 years old, I'd taken my first drink of alcohol, and alcohol became my mother, my father, my God, my lover, my friend, my companion, my support. And at some point, it had turned. And I believe it was in the middle of my first drink, but at some point it turned. And it began to strip me of self-esteem, self-worth, dignity, integrity, decency, honesty, pride, all the things we have going for us as human beings. And by the time I got here, it had taken it all. And alcohol controlled where I would live, where I would work, the people I would run with, and eventually the people I would run from. Alcohol fueled all my successes, and alcohol fueled all my failures, and I had no choices. I was damned to live the same way day after day after day after day, and I had no choice. And I was powerless. Whenever I do battle with alcohol, I lose. Whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it or I'm fighting it because you're drinking it. Whenever I get into the ring with alcohol, I lose. And that was my powerlessness. And that happens to me over and over and over. I have a disease. And it manifests itself in justification, rationalization, and denial. My son was 11 months old when I got sober. I never wanted to be a mother. I found out that is not adequate birth control, but my son was 11 months old, and I'd bring him to meetings with me. I didn't know what to do with him. I'd bring him to meetings, and one of you would take him, and you'd love him, and for an hour and a half, he'd be with you, and then you'd give him back to me. And you taught my son everything he knows. You taught him how to love, how to be kind, how to be decent. I couldn't teach him that stuff. I didn't know. You taught my son. You also taught him how to con and manipulate. So I guess you have to take the good with the bad. And he was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous, and when he was about, I don't know, 16, 15 or 16, people started saying things to me like, Patrick, I think Patrick's probably smoking some marijuana. I said, oh, no, not possible. He was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a disease, and when I get into the ring, I lose. And the school started calling me because his grades were slipping. And the counselor asked me if I thought maybe he was doing drugs. I said, oh, it's not possible. He was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he's just one of those kids that an education is not important. You know, when he's in his early 20s, it'll be important, and he'll buckle down then. I kept making excuses. I was in the ring, and I was losing. My roommate, who is much more snoopier than I am, one night I came home from work, and she had been, under the pretense of putting clothes away in his room, looked under his mattress and brought out a bag of, well, you know, teenagers, they put their clothes almost anywhere. She brought out a bag of marijuana and said she found it in Patrick's room. And out of my mouth, I said, oh, it must belong to one of his friends. And God will do for me what I cannot or will not do for myself. God won't do for me what I can do for myself. God won't send me money in the mail because I can go to work. But God will do for me what I can't do for myself. You see, I'm a single parent. I've raised my son alone. It's been he and I since birth. His, not mine. One Friday night about midnight, he came in the house, and I was sitting on the couch, and I stood up, and out of my mouth, God did for me what I absolutely would not do for myself, because I would have never said these words to my son. Out of my mouth come the words, are you loaded? And he didn't miss a heartbeat. He said, no, I'm just tired. He'd heard me say it over and over and over. And I looked at him, and I said, you have to make a choice. You can either smoke marijuana, or you can live in my house, but you can't do both. I would never have said that to my son. He was just about 18 years old, and he walked into his bedroom, and 10 minutes later, he came back with a backpack over his shoulder. And he had made a choice. Intellectually understand that choice. I made that choice over and over and over. I gave up everything for one more drink. I have made that choice day after day after day. The only thing I've ever wanted to do since I was in the fourth grade was be a writer. I had an opportunity to go to college and go into that profession. I gave it up for one more drink. I have made that choice. Intellectually, I understand that choice. But when my son walked out of his room with the backpack over his shoulder, it was the greatest pain I'd ever experienced as a mother. And he walked out of my house. And I sat on my couch and in pain that I didn't know what to do with. 16 years sober, I sat on my couch trying to decide if I should kill myself or drink, because those seemed to be the only two things that would alleviate the pain. And I sat on my couch trying to make the decision, and I sat on my couch trying to make the decision, and I sat on my couch trying to make the decision. For 2 days, I sat on my couch. You see, I know for me that it doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't even matter what I decide. What matters is what action I take, and I didn't take an action. I sat on my couch. And on the second day, the phone rang one day, and it was one of the women I sponsor, and I don't know about the people you sponsor, but they never ask me how I am. And I picked up the phone, and I started talking to her, and she started talking about him, and he's doing this, and he's doing that, and he did that. I mean, you know what? I've heard about him way too much. I know way too much about him, and And I said, listen, why... It's noon, why don't I meet you at the Canyon Club for the 12:30 meeting? We'll go to the meeting, we'll talk about him after. And I met her at the meeting, we talked about him after, and it alleviated a little bit of the pain. Didn't take it all away. I still have some of the pain, but it alleviated a little of the pain. And every day after that, every right action I took after that eliminated the pain a little more and a little more and a little more. And one more time it was affirmed to me, what is it I can do for you? How can I be of service to you? When I'm paying attention to you and what you need, God seems to take care of my stuff. When I'm not focused on me, when my focus is on being of service to you, God seems to take care of my stuff. And every right action has alleviated a little bit of that pain. My son never did move back in with me. He was living in his van in my driveway for a while, but we have a different kind of relationship today. You know what? I know we're all God's kids. And I know that my son knows where you are. And when he's ready, he'll be here. I have probably had several major Al-Anon slips. I just simply told him, you are an alcoholic and you need Alcoholics Anonymous and we have a seat for you. But in God's time, he'll be here with you because he knows where you are. And I'm grateful for that. And I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous for that. I just came here to stay out of jail. I want to talk for a few minutes about the steps because that's what happened. What happened for me, what it was like. I believe we all have the same story. I think we just acted it out a little bit differently. What happened for me is the 12 steps to recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. There is no way to get from where I was to where I am tonight, today, this morning, way too early, except through the power and the magic of the 12 steps to recovery. And this is just my experience. If you have a different experience with the steps, talk to your sponsor. This is my experience. For me, step two came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I'm a loner by nature. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't change your nature. But what it does is it gives me the courage and the strength to take the actions that I need to take in spite of my nature. The hardest thing for me to do is to come be with you. My preference is to sit on my couch. And you give me the courage and strength I need to come and be with you. My friend Cindy and I were in Florida a couple years ago and we were fishing. I love to fish. Throw and reel. I don't like to catch the fish because then you have to touch them and your hands get all smelly and it's really, really pretty nasty. But I like throwing and reeling a lot. And I'm throwing and reeling. Cindy goes into town, get more bait, comes back out. I'm throwing and reeling. She goes into town, has lunch, I'm throwing and reeling. She goes in to see a movie, I'm throwing and reeling. She goes and has dinner, I'm throwing and reeling. And like 12 hours, I'm throwing and reeling. And she comes back one more time, and I said, you know what, I am actually amazed at how much patience I have. I can't believe I could sit here all day and just throw and reel. She says, patience shit. She said, you are such a loner, this is a perfect thing for you because you don't have to talk to anybody. And that's my nature. Left to my own devices, that's my nature. You know if you're a loner if you have trouble with potlucks. If you have trouble with potlucks, you're a loner. I go to a potluck, I have this voice that says, what are you doing here? You don't know what you're doing. You don't know how to behave. You're not going to be able to talk to anybody. Nobody's going to want to talk to you. They're going to be... You know you're a loner. You prefer to sit on your couch and eat your green beans by yourself. And I have no problem with God. I want you to know I have no problem with God. I believe we are all God's children. Okay, I have one problem with God. I believe we are all God's children, and I have always wanted to be an only child. That's my only problem with God. Other than that, I have no problem with God. But when I heard step two, for me, the power greater than myself, for me, was not God. Because if God was going to restore me to sanity, I'd have sat on my couch. God would have flown by, sprinkled me with sanity, taken off to wherever it is God hangs out, and that would have been the end of it. I would have never had to do another thing. I'd be on my couch today. So for me, the power greater than myself was the action of steps 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I came to believe that through taking the action of the step, I would be restored to right thinking. I came to believe that through taking the action of the steps, when the tiger rolled over and kicked, I don't need to take a drink. I came to believe that through taking the action of the steps, when I do something alcoholic, I don't have to beat myself up for it. I came to believe through taking the action of the steps that when I have the thought, a drink would be nice. I just clap, I say thank you for your participation. I don't have to take an action on it, and I don't have to beat myself up. I'm an alcoholic, I will always be an alcoholic. And that's what I came to believe would happen if I took the action of the steps. Step three for me, I hear people talking about step three, and they ask me, say, what step are you on? They go, oh, I'm on the third step. Every morning I get up and turn my will and my life over to the care of God, but at about noon I take it back. And what step are you on? Well, I'm working on step three, and every day I turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I've turned my will and my life over to the care of God, except for my sex and finances, because I don't want to be poor and celibate. And I hear those people, I pretty much stay away from them, because I don't think they understand the step. I'm driving to work the other day. I go the same way to work every day. And I'm driving to work the other day, and I get up to this intersection, I got to make a decision. Turn right, turn left, or go straight. To get to my work, I got to turn right, so I make a decision to turn right, and I went straight through the intersection. And I made a U-turn, I came back toward the intersection, I'm coming toward the intersection, I got to make a decision, turn right, turn left, or go straight. Now to get to my work, I got to turn left, so I make a decision to turn left, and I went straight through the intersection. Made another U-turn, I'm going back. Coming up to the intersection again, make a decision, go straight, turn right, turn left. Now to get to work, I got to turn right and make a decision, turn right, and went straight to the intersection. I make another U-turn, I come back, I come to the intersection, make a decision, right, left, or straight. Now to get to work, I got to go left and make a decision to go left, and I do this with the steering wheel. And the decision that I made became a reality when I took an action, making a left-hand turn. The book says it, although our decision is vital, it has very little permanent effect unless immediately followed by action. If I hadn't taken the action with the steering wheel, I'd still be making U-turns up and down that street in the city of Orange, and somebody else would be here talking this morning. And that's all step three said to me, make a decision. Do you want to live your life as a chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic with no choices? Or do you believe the people in Alcoholics Anonymous who've talked about the fact that they don't drink, they've done some simple things, and they have a life beyond their wildest imagination? Okay, pick one or the other. Chronic alcoholism or a life beyond your wildest imagination? Which way do you want to go? Duh. I think I'll go this way, Mom. But just making the decision that I want what you have isn't enough. I got to do what you did. And the action for me is steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. I looked at the fourth step, and I thought it was nice. I thought writing inventory was going to be good for those of you who had no creative writing skills, but I'm a writer by training. I know how to write. I don't need to do this thing. I don't need to brush up on anything, and I didn't do it. And I didn't do it, and I didn't do it. And then something happened to me. I came, and I sat in the middle of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in pain. I felt different, unique, and alone. I felt separate from. I knew there was no sense sharing. You weren't going to understand anyway, and I left in more pain than I'd come in with. And I came back the next night in pain and sat in the middle of you and felt different, unique, and alone. I knew there was no sense sharing. You weren't going to understand anyway. And I left in more pain than I came in with. And I did that night after night after night. Until the pain of being with you was so great that I knew I had to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. And my way out of the meeting that night, I had one of my thoughts. And the thought was, before you leave Alcoholics Anonymous, why don't you try writing a four step? So I went home and I did my four step the way the book says to do it. I found the diagram. You know what? That book is really irritating. One lousy diagram. They could put a picture or two in there. I mean, it's one crummy break from the text. But I did it. I made the little column. Who do I resent? Well, everybody who breathed air that I thought should have been mine ended up on that list. What they did to me, well, I wanted to tell you all my life what they did to me. I was really having fun doing this. I was sorry I waited this long. And then in the third column, how it affected me. Well, it affected my self-worth, my self-esteem, my dignity. Well, no wonder I drank. If all these people did all these things to you, you'd have drank too. Well, you did, but... And I was really having fun doing it, and then in my zealousness, I accidentally turned the page to the big book. And two pages after the diagram, hidden in the body of the text, it says, referring to our list again, we put out of our minds the wrongs others had done, and we looked at what our part was. Well, now it wasn't any fun anymore. But I did that. I looked at my part. I did that with my resentments, my fears, and my relationships. And when I got done, for the first time, I saw who Patty O was. See, I never knew who. I always put on a show for you. My whole life was a show. I remember when we were kids, there were six of us. My father's a drunk. My mother's a major untreated Al-Anon. And we were at a picnic one day, and my mother set the old picnic out, and as soon as she got it set out, my father, the drunk, passed out diagonally across the blanket, across all the bologna sandwiches and potato salad. And it was sort of like a cue for the kids. We went nuts. We started ripping bologna sandwiches out from underneath them, throwing potato salad at one another. We were just out of control. And my mother, the untreated major controlling Al-Anon, was trying to, like, get us all into control again. And it was hopeless. She couldn't do it. And then she saw this family on the other side of the park. And my mother had an idea. And I think for an untreated Al-Anon, an idea is as deadly as a drink is for an alcoholic. Because my mother sees this family over there, and she says, it's all. Why can't we have a family like that? Why can't we be like, I mean, they have the dog, they're playing Frisbee, everybody's happy, they're all dressed up. My mother spent the whole next week putting the fear of God into us. The next Sunday, we went on another picnic. We took the dog, who had not been out of the backyard in 10 years. She laid out the blanket. She propped my father, the drunk, against the tree so that when he passed out, he went up against the tree instead of across the picnic. And we all sat there like ladies. We tried playing Frisbee with the dog. Didn't have a clue what to do. But we were having this really nice picnic, and I've often thought about that. And I thought, what if there was a family on the other side of the park looking at us, saying, why can't we have a family like them? And you see, that's how I spent my whole life. I spent my whole life putting on a show, being what I thought you wanted me to be, doing what I thought. I didn't have a clue who I was. When I did my fourth step, I saw for the first time who I was. And it wasn't, you know, that bad. It wasn't that good, but it wasn't that bad. Nothing flew out of my den that I didn't already know. And for the first time, I saw who I was. My life, it seems to me, may not be true, but it seems to me people hurt me all my life. It seems to me people let me down, they disappointed me, they hurt me. As a small child, I didn't want to be hurt anymore, and I started building a brick wall to keep you out. As a small child, I built a brick wall, and it kept you out, and I built it bigger and deeper and bigger and deeper, and it kept you out. And it kept you out really well. What I never knew is it made me a prisoner inside. I lived behind that wall in isolation and loneliness. But I had that big brick wall between me and you. And when I did my fifth step, that wall didn't crumble down. When I did my fifth step, one brick came out of that wall. And every time I have shared with another alcoholic, another brick has come out of that wall. Until today, I have no brick wall between me and you. Oh, I have a little styrofoam thing I throw up every once in a while, because sometimes I get afraid. And you know what? I thought if I worked the steps hard enough, good enough, long enough, if I worked with the newcomers, if I was of service enough, if I went to enough meetings, if I worked this program really, really well, really, really diligent, that it would somehow skyrocket above humanness. What I've discovered in working the steps is I've come into my humanness. And as a human being, sometimes I have fear. Sometimes I have insecurity. Sometimes I have self-doubt. Sometimes I feel inadequate. But the difference is I come here and you give me the courage and strength to walk through that. Those feelings don't immobilize me. I don't have to drink to make them go away. You give me the courage and strength I need to go through them. But you know what? Sometimes you're not there. And the little styrofoam wall goes flying up. And then somebody on the other side, one little poof, and it's down, and I'm, you know, on with my business. But I've been in the same job field for about 16 years now, and I'm fairly good at what I do for a living. But you know, sometimes I'm driving to work, and I have this thought: oh my God, today's the day they're going to fire you. Oh my God, today's the day they're going to find out you can't do this job. Today's the day they're going to call you into the office. And you know, and 21 years ago, I'd have that thought, and I would just be, as I'm driving my car, having the thought, I would just give a giant F-U to the universe, and who needs that crappy job anyway? Go into a bar, tell the bartender what a bunch of louses I used to work for, order a drink, badmouth them all over town, have another drink and another drink and another drink, and not even show up. That's what I used to do. But you've given me tools to go to take my hand and walk me through my humanness. So when I have feelings of inadequacy, I call my sponsor, and I tell her what's going on. You know what? She laughs. I don't know why, when it's her problem, it is very serious. But when it's my problem, she laughs. And she laughs and she says, honey, you know what? Just go ahead and go to work, and if it happens, call me. Okay, and I go ahead and go to work, and it doesn't happen. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous for that. I just came here to stay out of jail. But that has happened as a result of one brick at a time, that wall coming out between me and you. Step 6 and 7 for me, I believe, are the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. We tell people don't leave before the miracle happens, and then we don't tell them what the miracle is. For me, the miracle is step 6 and 7. When I got home from doing my fifth step, I started reading the big book. I didn't mean to recover this quickly. It's just by coincidence. I opened to that part of the book about step 6 and 7, and I started reading it. And I got lulled into it. When I became aware of what I was reading, I was in the middle of the seventh step prayer. And when I became aware of what I was reading, I took the longest journey we ever take. I took a journey from my head to my heart. And I finished reading the prayer. And when I finished reading the prayer, the thing that it says in the book happened to me. I walked through the archway to freedom. I walked away from the person I had been all of my life to start to become the person God intended for me to be. And I believe that's the miracle. And I think too many of us leave before that happens. The best I've ever described myself when I came here was an animal with latent human tendencies. That's what walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the steps work, because you've been willing to share with me, I've become very kind, very loving, very gentle, very caring. Of course, now they tell me it's codependency and I have to recover from it, but I love the person who I am today. I'm tempted to write a book, Women Who Love Themselves Too Much. But that doesn't mean it was zapped away. That doesn't mean the defects were zapped out of me and they're free-floating and you're going to have to worry about one of them crashing on you. I'm very anal retentive. I like to have little pictures. And my character defects, I pull around with me all the time in a little red wagon. My character defects were a survival kit that allowed me to live long enough to get to you. And I pull them around. I have them all the time. And you keep your hands out of them because they're right here in my little red wagon. And sometimes, you know what, I get afraid. Sometimes I feel too insecure. Sometimes I get, and you're not there. And I take one of those defects out of my red wagon and I use it. The difference is when I don't like the way it feels, not when you don't like the way it looks, but when I don't like the way it feels, I can ask God to remove it and he'll put it back in my wagon. But I always have them with me. I was, not because of me, but because of my job, I had to give a lecture on spirituality one morning and I left my house late. And I'm the kind of person, I think if I drive fast enough, I can get there on time, no matter how late I leave. I left my house and I was driving really fast. And I was going down the coast highway. There shouldn't have been any traffic. I ran into a traffic jam. Screeched to a stop. We move a little, stop. Move a little, stop. Now, I'm already anxious because I'm late. Move, stop. The guy behind me lays on the horn of his car. Now, I don't know where he thought I was going to go other than the trunk of the car in front of me. We move, we stop, he honks. We move, we stop, he honks. Now, I'm already anxious because I'm late. We move, we stop, he honks. I finally had had it. I put my car in gear, put the emergency brake on, and my dress-up clothes, my high heels. I get out of my car, I head for his. He had electric windows. He almost got them rolled up. He missed by about this much. Just enough for me to get my little arm in there. I got him by the collar of his shirt. I twisted it. I pulled his little face to the window. I started telling him about himself. I told him about his mother. I suggested he do some things that I really think are physically impossible, but I was, my veins on my neck were sticking up and my face was red and I was letting him have it, and I'm sure he didn't like the way it looked long before I didn't like the way it felt. And in the middle of letting him have it, I took a breath, and in that breath, I realized I picked that rage up out of my wagon. I realized that God had removed it. And that day I picked it up out of my wagon. I asked God to remove it again, and he put it back in my wagon. I wish I could tell you I let the guy go, but I didn't. I did loosen up just enough to let a little blood run into his face and told him I was sorry for how I behaved. I said, I believe every word I said to you, but I'm sorry for how I said it. And let him go. He rolled his window up that quick. I got in my car. We moved. We stopped. He didn't honk. We moved. We stopped. Traffic finally cleared. I got to where I was going. I gave the best lecture on spirituality I have ever given. And the reason I was able to do that is because the steps work. The reason I was able to do that, you see, I don't have to run that tape that says you're a lousy member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're really no good, you're not an example of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're no good, blah, 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 quack, 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 and stop and get a drink, because that's what I have to do. Because the steps work, I didn't have to do that. I asked God to remove it, he did, and I went on with my day. And that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. The miracle here is I'm not damned to continue to live that way. I can choose to do it different. I didn't like the way that felt. Next time somebody honks, I can choose to do it different. Nobody's honked at me since, but when it happens, I can choose to do it different. When I drink alcohol, I have no choices. I'm damned to do it that way over and over and over. Steps 8 and 9 for me, oh, you know what? I think I'm having menopause right before your very eyes. I'm just in the middle of the most extreme hot flash I ever want to have. Jeff Satan. Yeah, we are intimate here in Alcoholics Anonymous, aren't we? The 15,000 people in this room and everybody who hears it on tape. Steps 8 and 9 for me are conventional ways of getting rid of conventional guilt. I felt guilty because I was guilty. I did a lot of things to a lot of people for one more drink. I gave up a lot of stuff for one more drink. I pushed a lot of people away for one more drink. I felt guilty because I was guilty. Steps 8 and 9 got me right with you. And getting right with you, I got right with me. And getting right with me, I got right with God. It had never been that way before. It had never been enough. It had never been the right kind. Steps 8 and 9, for me, it was enough, and it was exactly the right kind for the first time in my life. It doesn't mean I don't want more. I want more. I'm a pig. I want what I have, but I look in your eyes, and I see there's so much more available, and it brings me back day after day to Alcoholics Anonymous. And for me, the amends were more than sorry. I said sorry all my life. It was more than saying, oh, sorry. Sorry I slept with your husband. Sorry I parked on your lawn. Sorry I robbed $17,000 from your business. Sorry, sorry, sorry. It was more than sorry for me. It was living my life differently. It was about living different, and I had to start doing that. I did that with my family. I became a daughter, and I became a sister. I'd never been those before. And I became a daughter, and I became a sister. And every Sunday for the first 15 years that I was sober, every Sunday I went to my mother's house. And I behaved as a daughter, and I behaved as a sister. And it took 15 years of living different before I felt like I had made my amends to them. It took 15 years of doing it differently, of sending birthday cards and Christmas gifts and being there and being there. I mean, I took my mother to the mall. I hate the mall. And I did those things that daughters do, and I did the things that sisters do. And I lived my life different. It took 15 years before I felt even with my family and a part of the family. I've never felt a part of them. And I feel a part of my family. And I made amends with them. And I was up here and at a work-related conference in October, and flew home on the 5th of October, and I landed in the airport, and I wear a pager now. I used to wear my garage door opener so that I looked important, but now I have a pager, and it writes little words to me, and I just turned the pager on and put it back on, and I was driving home, and the pager went off, and my nose needs to be about an inch longer, because I put my glasses down to here to read, and when you're driving on the freeway, it's a pretty deadly combination, but read the pager, and it was the message, call your brother Donnie as soon as possible, and I knew what it meant. And I called my brother, and my mother had passed away about the time that I landed. And you know what? I was right with my mother. There was nothing that that I could have said that I hadn't said, and I was right with my mother. It doesn't mean I'm not grieving. It doesn't mean I don't miss her. It doesn't mean that I'm not feeling the loss. But I was right with her when she passed away. There was nothing more that I needed to do, And I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous for that. I just came here to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal. And I have gotten so much more. Steps 10, 11, and 12 for me are the recovery steps. I hear people talk about maintenance steps. I don't know what you're maintaining. I'm always even, and that's nice. But they're the recovery steps. They're the steps that allow me to continue to grow in Alcoholics Anonymous. Step 10, and I look at them like going to the maid company. You know, I go to the maid company. I go in on the first floor, but I want to go to the second floor. And I'm basically a lazy person, so I go immediately to the escalator. I always go to the escalator that's coming down. You can get from the first floor to the second floor on the down escalator, but you got to keep moving. And that's what 10, 11, and 12 are. They keep me moving up the down escalator. If I stop using them, I don't hit bottom right away, but I start going down. If I start using them pretty quick, eventually I'm right back to where I was where I started. So they keep me moving up the down escalator. 10 says the process is powerful. Keep using it. Keep writing about it, talking about it, ask God to remove the defect, make amends when necessary, and then turn your attention to somebody you can help. What is it I can do for you? How can I be of service to you? The process is powerful. Keep using it. Step 11, I'm a simple person. My prayer in the morning is very simply, thy will be done. And I am so naive that I truly believe the rest of the day is God's business. My job is to not drink and to show up and live life to the fullest. The rest of it is God's business. I happen to be a formal meditator, but my best meditation comes in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is where I sit to get my answers to how to live life. I sit with you, and you tell me how to live out there. I hear somebody will say, take what you need and leave the rest. If I knew what I needed, I wouldn't be here. I don't know what I need, so I take it all. And I have used everything I have heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have used. Maybe not today, tomorrow, next week, or next month. But everything I've heard in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've used. I've heard you talk about losing jobs and not drinking. I've heard you talk about relationships ending and not drinking. I've heard you talk about good things happening and not drinking. And everything I've heard, I've used. And so I take it all. Step 12 is the greatest gift you've ever given me, the opportunity to give a little bit of this thing away to another alcoholic, an opportunity to give a little bit of my dark, desolate past, a little bit of that incomprehensible demoralization, a little bit of that despair to another alcoholic, to look another alcoholic in the eye and take their hand. Say, honey, you don't have to live this way anymore. Take my hand, come with me, sit in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you never have to live this way again a day at a time. I've heard people say, it's not been necessary for me to drink. I want you to know it's been very necessary for me to drink. It's been an emergency. It's been so necessary for me to drink. It's been overwhelmingly, incredibly necessary for me to drink. But because the steps work, because you take my hand and you say, honey, come sit with us. Sit in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous and you don't have to live that way anymore. Because you give me the hope. Because at the end of the meeting, the person on this side is going to give me a little courage and the person on this side is going to give me a little strength. I haven't had a drink since I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's been necessary a number of times. It takes a lot of courage to continue to choose to recover. Cowards drink and use. I know I did that on a daily basis for 13 years. It takes a lot of courage to continue to drink, to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have that kind of courage. And so I'll get a little strength, and I'll get a little courage, and you'll give me what I need to continue to choose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the greatest gift that I have to give to another alcoholic. I've done everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very judgmental. I love taking your inventory. I break my neck to go share it with somebody else. I've slept with newcomers. I'd do it again in a minute if I had a chance. Charged for a 12-step call one time. I was... got a 12-step call, and we went to this house, and I'll tell you what, if money could keep you sober, this woman had never had a problem. We spent a quarter of a tank of gas just getting to her driveway. We got to the house. She had a big old oak door that had to be 3 feet deep. I mean, those are expensive doors. We walked in. She came down a spiral staircase like that old Raleigh Hills commercial. She had on a gown with puke and wine, and she came spiraling down there, and I sent the other woman into the kitchen to make coffee, and I looked at this lady, and I said, you know what, I understand. It's not your fault that you can't stay sober. She'd been in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, I understand. It's not your fault. The reason you can't stay sober is the people in this town, it was where my mother lived, not where I live. I said, the people in this town won't tell you the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I live in another county, so I can't just give you the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous. But for $100, and... I should have asked for more because she pulled $100 out of her pocket without even blinking an eye. And she gave me the money and I looked her in the eye and I told her the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you don't drink, you won't get drunk. If you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And about that time, the woman came out of the kitchen. I said, we don't have to be here anymore. And we left. And when that lady took a cake for 1 year of sobriety, I gave her back her $100. And never once in, well, it wasn't her $100, but it was $100. Never once during that year did she ever tell anybody that I charged her for that 12-step call. And I've done everything wrong here. The only thing that I've done right, a day at a time, is I haven't taken a drink of alcohol. A day at a time, I haven't taken a drink of alcohol, and on the days that I don't take a drink, I have a chance to live life different. On the days that I don't take a drink, I can make a choice to live my life different. If I take a drink, I have no choices. When I was 4 days sober, an old man told me if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk. If I didn't get drunk, my life would get different. He didn't lie to me. He didn't tell me it'd get better. He didn't tell me my family life would get better, my job life would get better, my relationships would get better, my finances would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me it would get better, and I'm grateful because none of it has. So, it's a little hope for the newcomer, but it's all gotten different. And as I stand here this morning, I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I have never had it so good. You see, I don't know good from bad for me. I'm going through something I think is good for me, it turns out to be bad for me. I'm going through something I think is bad for me, and it turns out to be good for me. And I don't know good from bad for me. I've gone through times in my recovery where my whole life has fallen apart. I've gone through times where I've lost jobs, I've lost relationships, seems like everything I've worked for has been taken away from me, and I have believed that God brought me that far and then took off to take care of one of you and just left me. But I didn't drink and I didn't dine. I got far enough beyond it to every time in retrospect to see that when I thought my life was falling apart, what was really happening is it was falling together. And it had to be exactly that way for God to move me to where he'd have me be. See, I don't know good from bad for me, but I know different. Every year in my life is different than it was the day I walked the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a job that I really, really love, that I'm really, really good at. I have a relationship that I never thought that I could have because, you see, I don't know how to do that. I don't know. I'm a pig. I take. I don't know how to give. I don't know how to be a friend. I don't know how to let you love me, and I don't know how to love you. I think if I love you, I have to hurt you. If you love me, you're going to hurt me, and I don't know how to do it. And I listen to you, Sharon, today because you've been willing to share with me and because there's a very gentle and a very loving God. I have a relationship that's healthy and nurturing and loving, and I can come to Alcoholics Anonymous for that. I came here to stay out of jail. I have people in my life who love me, and I have people who I love. I have a relationship with my son that's God's business, not my business. I have relationships with my family that are healthy. My family doesn't understand. My family thinks my sobriety is a phase I'm going through. But I have relationships with them that are healthy, and my life is beyond my wildest imagination. I have a pretty wild imagination. And it's better than I could have ever imagined for myself. I want to end with a story. I think I have to end because Bob has to talk pretty soon, and we don't want the Al-Anons to get held up at all. I'll tell you what. You know what? The only reason I say tacky things about Al-Anon, truthfully, is because nobody ever stayed with me long enough to qualify for Al-Anon. That's the reason. That's the only reason. If anybody had stayed long enough, I wouldn't be talking this way. I'll tell you the story about the man that goes to see St. Peter, and he asks St. Peter to show him heaven and hell. St. Peter takes him to a room, and it says hell on the outside, and they open up the door, and inside the door is a banquet. Tables and tables of food, as much food as he could ever imagine, any kind of food you could ever think of. And the people sitting in that room were starving, they were dying, and they were hungry. And the reason they were hungry is they had those long wooden cooking spoons tied to their hands, and the spoons were just a little bit too long, and they couldn't quite get the food in their mouth, and so they sat amongst plenty, and they were dying. And that's how I was before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was out there amongst plenty, and I was dying. Then he took him to a room marked heaven, and inside that room was the same thing, tables and tables and tables of food, as much food as you could ever imagine, any kind of food you'd ever want. And the people in that room had those long spoons tied to their hands, too, and they couldn't quite get the spoon to their mouth, but the people in that room were full, and they were happy, and they were content. And the difference was, is one man was taking a spoonful of food, and he was feeding the man across the table. And he was taking a spoonful of food and feeding the person next to him, and she was feeding somebody else. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works for me. I don't have my own answers. I have to come here and I have to let you feed me. And every once in a while, if I'm lucky, I get to give a spoonful of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to somebody else. And you don't have to have a year, 5 years, or 10 years. If you have one day, you have something to feed to the man or woman walking through the door. If you have one day, you have something to give to the person coming in. When I was 4 days sober, an old man told me if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk. If I get drunk, my life would get different, and I am eternally grateful to him. And I always end with the same thing, and I end with it because it's been my experience. And I pray, God, that it's your experience. It's a line in chapter 5 that says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you.